It's time for Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice. Traditional small animal medicine and surgery, chiropractic, laser therapy, acupuncture, and Chinese herbal medicine. 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com. With us today, Dr. Carolyn Cannon, owner and chief veterinarian at the Millerton Veterinary Practice. Hello, Dr. Cannon.
Good morning. How are you?
Breathing. How are you?
We're all grateful to be breathing, aren't we?
Exactly. And we are so pleased to have you with us. And first question is from Franca in New Preston. Hoping you can help out with this because I don't want any more arguments with my husband. We have formed a pod with another family of four because our kids would go crazy otherwise. Anyway, everybody in the pod is good about following coronavirus protocols, except when it comes to our old, sweet, long-haired cat, Billy the Kid. Our friend's 3-year-old Max loves to pet and cuddle Billy. It's adorable, but being three, Max's hygiene isn't exactly perfect. I'm concerned he could inadvertently spread virus germs into Billy's long fur, and then someone in my own family could catch them. My husband thinks I'm being paranoid, so we're consulting the expert.
So, you know, the jury really is still out on this. There haven't been studies that show, as far as I have read anyway, that show that animals can act as a fomite. So basically what that means is that a piece of inert material, the hair, I mean, inert material that can pass virus from one person to another. We don't know how long it lives on their fur. What I can address is that across the country, the veterinary industry is handling in the areas where there's a lot of coronavirus. We're doing curbside service. Lots of people are still doing it, and there's been no discussion about workers at veterinary hospitals or veterinarians having an increased risk of developing coronavirus based on the work that we do. So does that mean that you're not going to catch it that way? Well, I guess I would be looking sort of outside that whole idea of, I'm not sure what it means to be a pod, but I don't know if families live together.
Yes, you make a group. Everybody,
make a group, but you don't live in the same house?
Yes, you live in the same house as a group, so basically you're exposed to each other, but you're not exposed. You've got other people, but you're living in one household, basically.
Okay, so living in one household, it seems to me most of the time people are not going to be wearing a mask in the house. And so my concern would be more about what is everyone doing when they're outside of the house, right? So if everybody's being careful about not bringing coronavirus into the house, then you shouldn't have to be concerned about that. I would be more concerned about the 3-year-old touching a piece of plastic that didn't get wiped down, or touching the floor where the virus might live for a longer period of time. But I can't say specifically how long does it live on the animals. I can tell you that my whole staff wears gloves when they handle them, that I don't because I can't do my work with gloves on, and that I do sanitize prior to touching them and then right afterward. I think that good practices are important in that way. So I think the bigger picture here would be to be careful in other areas and not necessarily only worry about the cat. 3-year-old is going to, if a 3-year-old is infected and not showing signs of disease, then it's likely, because you're not going to get them to wear a mask and be hygienic, it's likely everybody in the house is going to get coronavirus no matter what you do.
Right.
Yeah,
it's very interesting. You're just the common sense aspect of it. But I think that you raise an interesting point. You know, unlike, for example, at a meat packing plant or at a prison, there if you haven't had seen massive spikes in veterinarians across the country in various places, and they have been, you know, it has always been under the heading of essential worker.
Exactly. So we've been out here the entire time.
Right. It gives you some indication that again, there's so little no one is speaking with one voice, really. So you can't say this, but it is fair to surmise. That's what I'm going to say. It is fair to surmise that you have less. I'm going to take it upon myself to say you have less worry about Max and Billy the cat than you do about Max and just about everything else.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And I think it is fair to surmise that the veterinary industry has not had an increase in coronavirus compared to the general population, because there are big corporations that track these kinds of things, right? Banfield Veterinary Hospitals, VCA,
you would have heard about it.
Talk to each other all the time. And, right. So, it gets into a whole area of how long can the virus live, with us. Are you really okay if you're not careful all the time? So when I'm at home, we bring groceries into the house. So I don't touch my face even when I'm at home unless I've just washed my hands. So I just got into good habits early on in March, and I carry them over.
Right, and I think that that's ideally, this is me now. I think if you get into the good habits and you maintain the good habits, and you go from there.
And the important thing is not to expose the three-year-old to anyone or, any place where they might get coronavirus,
right?
Because they're going to be, you pick them up and they're going to be spitting in your face.
Right, exactly. It's a three-year-old.
Right.
Max is three.
Oh,
all right.
I know.
And that's, and there's a lot of this will work itself out, but I think you've addressed the fur thing, which is fortunately all you have to deal with. Catherine in Middletown, New York. On a really hot day, I worry about whether I should be forcing my dog to cool down. She's a 5-year-old terrier mix with medium-long fur. Our usual daily walk is about 4 miles long. The trail crosses multiple small creeks and brooks, but she absolutely hates to get in any kind of water. By the end of these walks, her fur is hot to the touch, so should I force it?
So that's a good question. A dog who's walking 4 miles a day is probably, with you, 4 miles, is probably going 8 miles and is pretty fit if they're off leash. Even if they're on leash, it's a good walk on a daily basis. So they're probably pretty fit, which is helpful as far as cooling down. But you mentioned terrier, so sometimes the terriers can overdo even because they have such drive. So high drive, not paying attention to their own physiology. So you have to be more careful, I think, with a dog like that. However, it sounds like if this trail's crossing creeks and brooks, the important thing is to get those feet wet. So, unless you're picking up your dog to cross the creek or the brook, then they're getting their feet wet and they're cooling themselves off in that way. You're going to watch for panting, and, that tongue is going to hang right down to their knees because if they're starting to get overheated. So, it's that kind of distressed look where the eyes are bulging and the tongue is down to the knees that tells you that, yes, you need to cool your dog off. But just touching the top of the fur is going to be pretty warm to begin with if you're out in the sun. So I don't know whether there's shade here, whether there's sun here, but I wouldn't, if your dog's not showing signs of distress, I wouldn't make them get into the water. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. And I think this is a good time to reiterate that if you cool off their feet or you cool off their belly, if you just have a little cloth even with you, a little...
Yes, and hold it under
the
area
them,
where there's not a lot of hair.
Then
feet is the most important, yeah. Let them stand in the water or just crossing the water.
Yeah, and it actually sounds... It sounds from this, we're not talking to her, so we can't ask her. But it sounds from this like as though what she's using to determine whether it's hot is that her dog's fur is hot, and that's not going to be your first sign of overheated.
Right. And, so they're going to dissipate heat through the mouth a lot. So the tongue will be out. It'll be bright red. But you can bring, to prevent that kind of thing, most people bring a water bottle. And so if you've got a little cloth, wet the cloth, wet the insides of her ears. She might not mind that. Make sure her feet are wet and the underside of her belly, and then you don't have to be concerned.
Yeah. All right. Glennon Falls Village, I'd like to know what you think about this drug for dogs called Apoquel. Have you seen these commercials? I'm interjecting here because they're probably one of the most effective commercials I have ever seen with the talking dog. I started seeing ads for it recently, and at first I thought maybe it could help my pup with her seasonal itchies. But then I thought that might be the drug they put her on 2 summers ago. If it is the same drug, what happened was as soon as the prescription ran out, the itchies came back only 10 times worse. Could it have been the same drug, or is Apoquel newer? If it's a new thing, have you had experience with it yet? Do you have opinions? Also, the ad says the side effects could include skin parasites getting worse. Are there some conditions it would treat better than others?
So, interestingly, I haven't seen any ads, but I guess I don't get much television. So what I can address with Apoquel is that everything that I know about Apoquel and in its use, it shouldn't worsen the itch after you use it. It is an immunosuppressive drug, just like steroids are, only it's very different. It works in a different way than the corticosteroids do. And so it carries fewer side effects. Excuse me. And it is, it targets cytokines, which are inflammatory mediators. So they cause inflammation in the skin. And it targets and reduces some of the cytokines that cause inflammation, particularly a particular one, interleukin 31, which I always remember. I don't know why, but that one is very specific to causing itch in dogs. So it's more effective in reducing itch and therefore increasing their comfort with a lower level of side effects. It's been out for at least 2 years, maybe 3. Maybe it went to the veterinary dermatologist first before it came to the general population of veterinarians.
I'm looking actually here, so I see an ad for it going back to 2017.
So there you go.
I would think that.
So it's a fairly new drug, and there aren't long-term studies on it yet. But if you talk to the dermatologists who use it on thousands of animals, then the side effects tend to be low. It can cause some, so these, the way that it suppresses the cytokines is a particular way that also is important for bone marrow. So it can suppress bone marrow, although it's pretty low numbers of animals. So I believe it's 1% or 2%, maybe 1% where it might suppress bone marrow. And the bone marrow rebounds pretty quickly if you take them off the drug. So it's important for monitoring. So, you know, we monitor, usually I'll do blood work, especially in older animals, prior to use, and then 2 or 3 months later, repeat a CBC, a blood count, so that I can see whether there's any suppression. These animals may, I had read recently that these animals may actually reduce their white cell count to the lower end of normal, but we don't know whether that's even significant to their health. So, you know, there are some side effects. It is, when we think about allergies in dogs, the only way to effectively deal with the underlying cause is with allergy testing and shots and allergy shots. And they don't always work. So I see dogs who've been through that whole ringer and haven't been helped. And I've seen dogs on really good diets still be itchy. So, you know, it has been a wonder drug for some dogs who have been really miserable and they can't take steroids because of the side effects. And so if you keep them on it, sometimes just during that really itchy season, and, you know, if it's a couple of months they're on it, they do well on it, you monitor them, you know, it can be a real boon to life quality. So I was very careful with it at the beginning, but now I'm pretty happy with it when used in the right circumstances. The problem with it, you know, in young animals is it can suppress the immune system. So you're not supposed to use it in dogs less than a year old, or it's not FDA approved. We can use things all the time that are off-label because we have to as veterinarians, but it's not recommended. And so I believe that what's been seen is some increase in the demodectic mange mites. And we know that that is most commonly occurs in young dogs, demodectic mange and pneumonia. So we don't use it. I don't use it on puppies.
Okay. As I say, if you do see the ad, and you can find it on YouTube, obviously, it's very... I would be shocked if people aren't or don't start coming in if they've got it asking for it. It's one of those.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I mean, people do ask for it, and they have been for a long time. And I'm now this year, you know, last year and this year, more comfortable using it in the right circumstances. What you don't want to do is have a dog with a skin infection and put them on Apoquel, and then they don't itch anymore, and people don't pay attention to the fact that their skin is getting really bad, especially the bottoms of the feet, et cetera. So it has to be used in the right circumstances, and it has to be talked about, you know, what to pay attention to.
And is it but you can only get it from a vet, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so that takes some of the sting out of it, because one of the basic tenets of pharmaceutical advertising is that they want people to go ask for this. You know, basically go menace your provider.
Yeah, so it definitely needs to be monitored. It's not that kind of thing that you can just, you know, call up and say, I need some more Apoquel.
Right. And so that's...
unless it's been a long-term management issue.
And that's why I was... That's why I started it by saying, oh, have you seen this? Oh, have you seen this? Because...
I will watch it.
All right. I've made you curious. All right. You'll be so shocked. It's another COVID question. Every time we hear in the news... this is Blake in Schenectady. Every time we hear in the news that some cat or dog or a tiger in the zoo has tested positive for COVID-19, it concludes with something along the lines of, but it doesn't pose any threat to pets. I'm curious if you, as a veterinarian, have knowledge of where the research is coming from here. For example, how do they know that animals aren't asymptomatically passing it to humans? It's not like there's been a worldwide effort to test, for example, house cats, so how do they even know? And what about the animals that live alongside people that aren't pets, like city rats and house mice? Can you shed any light on this with some insider's knowledge?
Yeah, this is all about epidemiology and tracking cases of COVID. So, you know, we know that... I don't think there are a lot of large studies that are done, because there's no indication at this point that it needs to be done. So the cats and dogs are not getting sick with COVID. That is my understanding. If you have a dog, you're really suspicious because someone in the family or a couple people in the family have been sick, and you're very suspicious that they are they might be a carrier or they might be having symptoms, then we contact, as a veterinarian, you contact the state vet, and the state vet looks at the case, probably may or may not talk to the people who have the cat or dog, and... they decide whether it is warranted to test. If we test these animals across the board, you know, it's the idea with not testing them is to not cause panic, because we aren't seeing epidemiologically any evidence that people are getting this from their pets, especially with contact tracing involved. You know, so we go back to. These large groups of veterinarians as an industry, we're not seeing that. There's no indication that the cats are getting sick, especially cats, but dogs, too, are getting sick with some strange disease that we can't identify.
Right.
Right?
Maybe
they're asymptomatic. Are they actually carrying something? If they are, why are not more people? Have cats and dogs.
But that's where you start. And, again, you raise an excellent point. Sadly, in my view, most of the reporting on this is, and people have been basically for an extended period of time, unless you are in an essential industry, you were home with your screen, and sadly, the information that you were getting was not necessarily screened. So it's very hard to get from a screen a sense of the scope, especially when your entire sense of scope is being informed by these numbers that are just these numbers and these pictures constantly. So
yeah.
You don't think about the fact that there is something called epidemiology, and that there are methods, because it's a science, there are methods for approaching it. So
and every veterinarian is trained in epidemiology, more so than, I believe, probably than than human medicine.
Right.
Because it's a big thing with us with food animals, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's part of it. And as far as the rats and the mice carrying it, so most viruses are species specific. So it's not much of a thing to pass viruses between people and pets. They can jump, from a particular. So in other words, if this came from bats, it's possible that it jumped to humans from bats. Probable that human couldn't transmit it back to a bat, though.
Right.
So, the way that viruses historically have behaved does not indicate, and the epidemiology does not indicate any evidence that this is being transmitted by animals.
And that, as you rightly and helpfully point out, is something that veterinarians are trained in, since in a lot of cases they're dealing with the various animals that would be that would interact with one another that might cause or transmit, which is the basis of other viruses that have been managed, shall we say, over time. And the only reason I'm making that little speech is because of the next question, which you've already answered three times.
Okay.
But it comes from Larissa in Rhinebeck, and it is, okay, so they say it's super rare for a pet to get coronavirus, but obviously it has happened. So what I don't get is, what are we supposed to do if our dog or cat starts coughing? Are we supposed to go to the vet right away, or is there a place we can call? Or just don't worry, because the odds are like winning the lottery, but in a bad way. I'm so confused.
So I would be concerned if your dog or cat starts coughing, and just as you normally would, you would call your veterinarian. It's more of a concern if someone in the family has had exposure with this pet, someone who's been sick with coronavirus, has had sort of long-term exposure. The recommendation by the CDC is to keep your pets away from you if you're sick, and isolating yourself in the house to try to not have, unfortunately, contact with your dogs and cats, so that they might become carriers. But absolutely, if your dog or cat is exhibiting coughing signs, that's a problem. And so go to the veterinarian. We are trained to rule out all of the common causes of those symptoms. And then if we are concerned, especially if you have someone in the house or someone that your pet's been exposed to who's been COVID positive, coronavirus positive, then we would talk to the state veterinarian,
right,
who's dealing with all these cases.
I think that, again, one of the issues is going to be the whole asymptomatic aspect of it. And that's understandably got people confused, because if no one in the household, the thrust of this particular question, I believe, is, okay, if no one in the household is COVID positive and your pet starts to cough, does your pet have coronavirus? But the actual answer is, if your pet starts to cough, and call the vet and let the vet and convey that my pet is coughing and no one in the household has coronavirus or COVID-19.
Right, right. Or maybe my cat visits, all over the neighborhood, that kind of information, and people let them in the house, and that kind of thing is valid. But so far, we do know that cats have gotten it, have been able to have the virus from living with people who had coronavirus.
And recovered.
But there's no evidence that those animals have passed it to anyone else.
Even to each other?
That I can't say for certain.
And that's, again, this is just where it gets confusing, because you're getting a snapshot of a moment, but you're not getting the whole thing. In the two cases that were in the news, it was clear in each one of them that their handlers had had it.
That their handlers have had it, and that they have not the
and no one has expired,
not died from it or had very serious symptoms.
Right,
they've all recovered.
Exactly, including the handlers. So that was the happy news. And again, that's not something that's often.
Yeah, I mean, these are important questions, and I hope that I just answered them. Nobody really knows. Nobody really knows for sure. But certainly, there's no epidemiologic evidence that animals are transmitting. And this was more of a concern. I would have been more iffy about this in March, way more iffy, because we were very concerned and we were super careful. But even with collars coming into the building, et cetera, leaving all the collars and leashes out in the breezeway, and we're still using our own leashes and we're sanitizing those leashes after every pet. However, I am much more relaxed about even dealing with a pet without, you know, screening every single person who comes in, who they've been in contact to, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, and this is one of the benefits of being 3 months into something, which, again, our life doesn't necessarily encourage people to say, it's like, okay, well, we're moving along here. We've got a little bit more tangible information.
Yeah.
Which is key. As usual, thank you very much, Dr. Cannon.
Thank you.
This has been Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com.